the turn of the century, I was working at Mattel Toys, like 2001, 2002, when I first started there.
Uh-huh.
And one of the older dudes who lived out in Burbank comes into work one day and he goes, you're a cartoonist, right? And I go, yeah. And he goes, you won't believe what I got this weekend at a garage sale. And I go, what? He goes, I got an original Disney animation desk for $150.
Holy shikes.
For people that are in the know about those Disney animation desks, they almost have like this storied history.
Yeah.
They were this beautiful custom-built animation desk that I think the first version Walt himself approved the design of. Anyway, they're amazing desks. And there was when Disney got rid of their animation building in Burbank a decade or so ago, all of a sudden around Burbank, there was a flood of them like on the back loading docks of Disney, and then they all sort of disappeared.
Oh,
and there's various
gosh.
Stories about where they went and what happened to them. And did they destroy them? Did they sell them? Anyway, this guy, though, the dude that I worked with at Mattel, he was going just driving by a garage sale, pulled over, and the woman was a widower of not one of the original, you know, the big, what are they called, the Magnificent Seven or whatever those big animators were, but just an original Disney animator that when he left Disney, he got to keep his desk.
Oh, my.
And then when he passed, she kept it for a few years, and then at a garage sale, she's like, I don't need it. Well, let's say $150. Meanwhile, those desks, if you put them up on eBay, they go for like $8,000-$9,000. I've seen one in really good condition, the one for $10,000.
Wow.
And so I tell you this entire story just to let you know that this is your nerd of a friend. Every time I go to anything in Burbank, an event, a meetup, a lunch, a dinner, I will be honest that I drive up and down maybe one or two more streets than I need to, just because I'm like, dear God, let me pass by a garage sale that has a Disney animation desk. That's all I want. I just want a sweet...
It's become your white whale.
My Burbank white whale, yeah. I want one of those sweet, sweet desks. I want it so bad.
Well, wait a minute. What about your friend from Mattel? How old is he?
Oh, Bradley, wait a minute. So you're saying if I murder him,
ingratiate yourself. But, you know, maybe every now and again, take him out for some fried foods, maybe ply him with some beer, you know, clog those arteries up and build friendship at the same time. And then when he kicks, maybe you're in the well.
You know what, Brad?
Yeah.
There are worse plans in the world. You're just saying I need to be a nice person.
Yeah.
This is a hard plan. All right.
Well, if you call intentionally clogging his arteries in the aim of trying to induce a cardiac arrest nice, then yeah, you're sweet as hell. But I'm seriously, have you thought about keeping in touch with this guy?
Well, as is true with every social situation in my life, it's out of sight, out of mind. And so as soon as I left Mattel, I was like, bye, 10-year friendships. I'll see you all if I ever see you again.
You keep in touch with nobody?
Maybe one or two people I keep up with. But for the most part, it being L.A., it's if you have to drive anything over 15 minutes, it's friends you never see again. You're like, bye, have a great life.
Yeah, we're done here. I'll be looking at your posts on Facebook from time to time. Aside from that,
congratulations on your marriage. Congratulations on your divorce. Bye. You know, like that's the only times you chime in. Anyway, so if you live in Burbank and you see Dave Kellett driving up and down the streets of Burbank, now you know why I'm rolling the roads. I'm looking for that sweet, sweet animation desk for $150.
Oh,
from a kind old widower.
Yeah, miracles can happen.
Yeah. Well, me being married at all is proof of that, Brad. So that's
yes,
that's
it
true.
Is. Yes, it is.
Well, on that note, friends, let's say a big hello and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. Whoa. Yeah.
And Brad, I got to ask you, because I didn't notice it until I listened to you right there. It sounds like you got a little sniffle in your snuffle.
Yeah, I have not started a two-pack-a-day habit. There's been a little summer cold that has been steadily making it through each one of the family members. And I'm the penultimate one to get it. My wife is the last person standing.
Well, now we know who is the healthiest in the house.
Yes.
And it's not Brad Geiger.
No, definitely not.
I'm sorry that you're not feeling great, but your optimism and cheerfulness is still here. That's good. That's a good sign.
That's right. Still standing. And really, it's just a little congestion. I don't feel bad. It's just I'm a little wheezy.
Well, on the note of your voice, I actually have some fun news that I want to share with everybody for the show. So if you guys remember when we did a little push in the past where we were trying to get 5-star reviews on iTunes, thinking maybe that might help get the word out about the show. We got to the 5-star ratings that we wanted, which I think was 100, 150. I don't remember what it was now. And so we did a show called...
I think it was an even 100.
Was it even 100? Is that what it was? Okay. We did a show called Drunk Comic Lab. And we have a new fun thought that we would like to get to. We are now hovering about 200 patrons on Patreon. And we had the fun idea that once we reach 250 of you joining us on Patreon, we are going to do a video version of Comic Lab where Brad and I will sit mics and headphones on, but with cameras. The logistics are still to be worked out, but we're tech savvy enough we can figure this out, these two old men. I think it'd be super fun. It'd be fun to see Brad's noggin as he makes you smile. That's I gotta tell you, there are worse things.
Well, not only that, sometimes we talk about things on the show that's a little bit visual. And it would be nice to do a version of the show every once in a while. This is still going to be a podcast, but to have something that we would put up as a Patreon exclusive where we can maybe do a tutorial type thing or just kind of show you what we're talking about instead of trying to explain it. A video version of the show as a intermittent thing wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
And maybe a little something extra for everybody, a little camera pan down Brad's calves. That's something the whole world wants to see.
I'm telling you, if I had a good feature, I think it'd have to be my calves.
I would say it's your calves.
I've got amazingly well-defined calves.
Yeah, you can cut a full block of cheese with those calves. That's amazing. Cut a full block of cheese. What a weird phrase that is. Why did I go with that?
Yeah, there you go again. I did not cut the cheese for the last time.
I like it when my brain offers up the weirdest possible version of cut a full block of cheese. Where did that come from in my brain? Anyway, so Brad, the thing that I want to talk to you about this week, because I think this is fun. We've been talking a lot about business. We've been talking a lot about Patreon. But I wanted to talk with you about some cartooning basics, because you had a fun topic that came up the other day in your reading where and you want to explain it to me about exclamation points in lettering.
This is something that I was surprised to find out was actually a heated debate in lettering circles among comics letterers. Should you have an exclamation point with a sound effect? And I know what I think, and I just wanted to hear what your opinion is.
Okay, so before you tell me anything about who and what we're making this argument online, you just want my straight up opinion?
Yeah. I'm not going to say if you say a certain way, I'm not going to say, well, Nate Picos disagrees with you. I don't know where certain letterers fall. All I know is that it is a heated debate, and I guess I should also add. That we're talking about like a loud sound effect, not like a kitchen sink dripping, although that you could also make the argument one way or the other, but like a kablam or a kapow.
Right. A single word, Colossus punching the blob or something, right? You want a full.
Exactly.
A funk. Yeah, I gotcha.
That's more of a Cthulhu, but go ahead.
Wait, no, hold on. Colossus metal hitting the blob, an immovable object.
You need a more duller sound. It's not going to be bam. That's a sharp sound. Blob is soft. That's going to be a kathoom. That's textbook sound effect.
Your onomatopoeia is off point, my friend. This is not. You are not thinking through the parameters of what.
What sound effect do you think it is?
Well, the whole point of the blob's powers is he changes his molecular structure, doesn't he? So that he can become an immovable object. He can become super dense. Isn't that the whole thing with the blob?
I don't know. I always thought he like extended a force field under the ground that rooted him to that place.
What? Well, boy, we do not know what the blob can do. Two dudes that barely remember Marvel Comics.
You gotta agree with me at this point. It's a more It's not a sharp sound effect. It's going to be a more rounded, dull sound effect.
Yeah, okay. You know what? You have to match the visuals of that the reader is seeing. And he's a very fleshy dude, but bump. And so I think you're right that you would. You know what? I'm going to go on record. Brad's right with C'Thoom. It's not. Wouldn't have been my first choice, but it's in the wheelhouse of where you want to be. Anyway, have a good week, everybody. This has been Comic Lab, your show about making comics.
And making a living from comics.
All right. So we're going to get the longest email about, actually, the blob, as he was first invented in 1982, was the blob was... all right. So anyway,
well, do you want to circumvent it here? I've got the wiki up right now.
I really thought you were going to say you want to circumcise this. You want to circumvent this. All right. Yes. Go ahead.
He can alter his personal monodirectional gravity field beneath himself to make himself virtually immovable as long as he's in contact with the ground.
Oh.
The only reason I interrupted you is because it proved that I was right. Other than that, I want to let you keep going.
Oh, my God, the smallness of that is delightful. Oh, wow.
How long have we been doing this show? You know how petty I am. I've got to have these little victories. I got nothing else in my life. I got to have this.
You're like at home with a pipe. I need this. I need to win on the blob.
I need a win. I need one in the W column, for crying out loud.
The science of this is ridiculous, though. His foot just needs to be touching the earth. Like, why would that affect how he affects his own gravity field? That if you're floating, if you're able to... Oh, that makes me angry. Anyway, all right. I can see, though, you know what, though, from a storytelling perspective, actually, that's a great way to do it, where if you can lift him up off the ground, he's powerless. That's great.
Then you've got at least some way of getting around that.
So what you need is Colossus to C'Thoom him up into the air, and then before he can, there you go. Yep. We did it, Brad.
And then the question is, when he does C'Thoom him, exclamation point or no?
Well, to me, okay, this is an interesting point. There are sound effects words that are more requiring of an exclamation point. And C'Thoom ends with a closed mouth sound, An oom to me is not a exclamation point word. A kang, where the lips are out and your cheeks pull back. A wham, where your chin drops and your lips pull back. That's an exclamation point word.
Wait a minute. Wham, you end with a closed mouth. It's an M.
Wham.
Mm.
Wham.
Wham.
Yeah, well, okay. I'm gonna allow that, counselor.
I'm still trying to get my head around this whole. I was thinking three different ways that you could approach this, and mouth position was not in the top 10.
Oh, Brad, I'm always thinking about mouth position. You.
Yeah, I should have guessed, but no, you go on with this. I'm fascinated by the Dave Kellett, the sounding out a mouth position theory of exclamation points.
Well, for my 10 years at Mattel Toys, a good 6.5, 7 of them, I was a copywriter, and I would have to name all of Mattel's, not all of Mattel's toys, but a lot of them. And you might say to yourself, well, that's not a lot of toys, but Mattel has something on the order of 2,000 trademarks. It's a ridiculous number of trademarks. It's almost, I think it's either the highest or the second highest number of trademark filings in the U.S. And so we were constantly coming up with names, right? Little Boopsie, Diggle Wiggles, all this sort of stuff, right? All, you know,
what was your favorite toy that you named?
Oh, God, I don't know. You're putting me on the spot there. But anyway, I want to get back to the point about naming.
Okay.
To me, one of the strongest things you could do in a name is when you could end a name in a smile. And it's not an accident. It's not an accident when you go through a lot of toys that they all end in smiles for little kids.
And that would be something with an E on the end, right?
Like, right. So you have Barbie, Pauly, Hot Wheels. I'm trying to think of all the other ones. I'd made a whole list of them, and so many of them end in a smile. And I was like, this can't be accidental from a copywriting standpoint, that there is a super subconscious thing about a name, a really resonant name for kids that ends in a smile.
Wow.
And if you look at, like, from a naming structure standpoint, whenever J.R.R. Tolkien would name something, his words, and it was something, an evil force, whether it was Morgoth or Sauron or Saruman, it was a chewy word that was uncomfortable to say.
Yeah.
Like Gondor is a name that is strength. Gondor, two easily strong syllable combinations. The Shire is almost ends with a lyrical wispiness.
Yeah.
But if you look at all the names that are the evil forces of Tolkien's work, they're uncomfortable. They're almost Germanic sounding, uncomfortable names to say. A lot of THs, a lot of Gs, a lot of heavy Rs. You know. We went down a rat hole as far as naming. But anyway.
Yeah. Oh, I'm fascinated.
Yeah. So for me, lettering is the exclamation point is, well, let's get into a bigger topic of why an exclamation point is helpful. To me, lettering and specifically sound effects are like a third piece of the puzzle working for you to create a mood, a tone, a style of a comic. Wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. Like,
You have the characters and the character design and the look of them. They immediately communicate the strongest point about what you're about to read. And then the text and the word choice and the diction all contribute to the overall tonality of the strip or comic. And then a really big and frankly an unsung hero of comics is the lettering, both in terms of body text and sound effects or special effects words.
Yes.
And so for me, the choice about whether to do an exclamation point or not with a sound effects lettering is entirely subjective into the mood that you're trying to create. So if you have a thunk that you want to put a bullet on is like, this is the end of that fight scene, then the thunk has a period on it, not an exclamation point, you know, that kind of thing.
I would grant you that.
Yeah. And if it's a turning point in a fight where our hero who has had three pages of being just gotten the shit kicked out of him, If he or she suddenly turns around on page four and it's the first successful hit that they've landed, that wham, you might want to put an exclamation point on there because you're excited that it's happening, you know?
Uh-huh.
So for me, it's both a sound of how does it feel in terms of how a reader will sound it out in their mind, and also the look and feel and tone that story needs at that moment. So now I've talked too long. What do you think about an exclamation point?
Well, you know me. I'm a rule of thumb guy, and I like rules of thumb with the understanding that it's can be broken under certain circumstances. And that being said, I probably come a lot closer to agreeing with you than disagreeing. My overall rule of thumb is that sound effects should not have a exclamation point or any kind of punctuation, because their whole nature, the fact that you're making them big, you're making them in this display font, you're making them expressive, that is an exclamation point of its own. When I all of a sudden use this big jagged font that floats above and it's outlined and reversed out and all this other stuff, to add an exclamation point to all of that is redundant. That being said, I do agree with what you're saying, is that sometimes a punctuation mark can be emotional. In other words, you had the perfect example, a thunk that ends a scene, like the hero falls after being knocked out and his body hits the floor and it's the end of act one, right? Thunk, period. Right. That I get. And an exciting, for example, it might be an ironic punctuation mark. The guy is trying to fix his sink because it's dripping, and drip, 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 no punctuation mark, drip, 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 no punctuation mark. He fixes the sink. He goes to bed. He's got the red eyes. He's got to be up in the morning. We've all seen these, I think I'm doing a Daffy Duck animated short verbatim, but anyway, he finally gets to bed and all of a sudden the sink starts dripping. That first drip might have an emotional exclamation point to it. Not a functional one, but like, here we go again. So in my head, exclamation points and other forms of punctuation do not belong in sound effects unless there's an emotional reason, because there is no grammatical reason to do it, because all of that display visual that you're putting into typography makes an actual exclamation point redundant.
I will say that between the two of us, all of those considerations are a viable way to figuring out with your lettering the critical question of whether or not you need a. So now tell me, now that we've both put our opinions forward, what was the consensus among the greats that you were following that were fighting over it?
I don't have any more to add to that other than to say that it was something that I never even considered was so much as a question. And I found out through just seeing a couple of random tweets that it was a much bigger debate than I had given it credit for. But I don't know like what the consensus is. We might put a poll up on the Comic Lab Patreon page to see what our followers think. But I don't know what consensus is. No.
Well, another way to look at this is that, you know, let's look at it like a keyboard. All those keys, all those marks, all those iconographic letters and numbers and dashes, they all have a use. So if you, in a way, as a cartoonist, are telling yourself akin to a pianist who says, I can use all these keys except for the F sharp. It feels like, I mean, why limit yourself? If you're the mood of your comic calls for that exclamation point in your lettering, then I'm more apt to just say, go for it. It's follow your heart. What does your heart tell you, Brad? That's so what I say.
There is a podcast called Hidden Brain, and it's a wonderful podcast. It's an NPR podcast, and they talk about this song and this particular recording, which a jazz pianist made. And the funny story about it is that just before this recording was to be made, the jazz pianist refused to come out on stage because he had done the show for less money than he usually does it. If I remember the story right, he was kind of doing this as a favor. And this person who was putting the event together was kind of a first timer at this. And this person did not have the piano properly set up. In fact, the piano was in such bad shape, there was several keys that did not work. And yet, people were sitting in the audience to see this person perform, and they were going to do a recording. So he had to go out and perform against his better judgment. This person begged him not to storm away. And he went out, and he performed this jazz performance in which he had to avoid certain use of the pedals that didn't work. He had to avoid certain keys that would not strike. And there was a number of other technical problems that he had to overcome. And he did this lyrical, moving, amazing performance that has gone down as, if I'm telling the story correctly, one of the best, most requested, most loved jazz recordings ever. And it was all because he was limiting himself. He couldn't allow himself to play the full piano. He was limiting himself to just the certain keys, and it forced him to improvise. It forced him to do things. It forced him to use his full powers as a jazz musician at their absolute height. And it got one of the best jazz recordings ever out of it. And so when I hear you say that, I want to remind you that purposefully limiting yourself sometimes is a way of forcing ourselves to bring our other powers to the forefront.
And just to remind everyone at home, this week, we forgot to mention it up front, but this week is Brad beating the shit out of all Dave's opinions. So that's what...
Dave, every week is that week.
Hey, Brad, I think the sky is blue. Dave, I'm so sorry you're full of shit on this one. Hey, Brad, I'm feeling like I'm in a good mood. Well, you shouldn't be, jerk.
You shouldn't. You don't even know how to tie your shoes. Look what you did there. I'm getting you Velcro.
So, all right, I'm not gonna pirouette on my opinion, but I will say this. There have been times, I'm not comparing myself to this jazz musician, but I'm sure you can relate to this. There have been times where with Sheldon, I still draw with ink and pen and brush and pencil and paper and eraser. There have been times where I didn't have, because I was on the road or something was wrong, I didn't have one or two key parts of what is normally a well-oiled machine of how I create a Sheldon. Uh-huh. And I had to, on the fly, reinvent how I was going to draw this. In fact, I can think of some specifics where I didn't have a pencil, and I'm very strong in my pre-sketching with Sheldon, right? I didn't have a pencil, and so I had to figure out how to do it. And what I ended up doing was literally scratching the page with a key, I think, to give myself marks on the page that obviously wouldn't be scanned, but that I could see. I used a car key just from my pocket and basically sketched out the comic with a key on the paper as a mark making. And all this is to say that, like that jazz musician, I looked at it at the end and was like, this is actually a really great, like, I like the way that I did this. And it required me, I had to jump through more hoops, but in a way, my mind was more focused, if you know what I mean, because I couldn't passively draw it. I had to actively draw it. And I couldn't just put myself in third gear. I had to constantly be dancing into how I was going to create this comic, because it was so new and different and fresh that I had to engage my creativity as I was doing it in a way that I don't normally do. So yeah. I agree with you that jazz improvisational story sounds very real to me, because I know in my own experience that that's happened a couple different times in my career when I didn't have the right equipment to do what I needed to do.
Yeah.
So as we're learning this week, I'm wrong in all instances and Brad is right once again.
Well, I'm going to get that needle pointed and send it over to you on a pillow.
Oh, great. Thank you. And the needle point is just going to say, Dave, everything in your life is a sham, including your marriage. And I'm just going to be like, thanks, Brad.
Dave, don't piss me off. This is just proof that I can stab things 2,000 times and not get tired. So one little pro tip I want to share about sound effects, because I'm actually a little fascinated by this. A couple things I want to talk about, pro tips. Number one, if you're doing digital lettering, go out and buy a few digital fonts that are specifically set up to be sound effects. Comicraft has some great ones. Blambot has some great ones. And I'm going to remind you again, don't forget, Comicraft has that sale on January 1st every year, where even their most expensive $200-$300 fonts are based, they're priced based on the year. So January 1st of this year, every font was $20.18. And next year on January 1st, every one of their fonts will be $20.19 a piece. I always load up on sound effect fonts on January 1st from Comicraft, because they've got some great ones. And also, don't use it in a straight rectangle. Don't use it straight out of the box. Take that sucker into Photoshop and give it a little text arc. Give it a little bend. Make it wrap a little bit. There's nothing more amateur than a sound effect that exists on a straight horizontal baseline. Give that sound effect some character. Make it leap off the page. It should be something more than just a straight piece of letters on paper or letters on pixel on a screen. It should have its own bounce. It should have its own personality. And finally, if you're ever wanting to challenge yourself to go beyond the sound effects that Dave and I talked about, the Krathoom and the Kabam and all that stuff, for you younger people, check out this guy. And Dave knows exactly who I'm going to say. In fact, you just fill it in. Used to work for Mad Magazine. He's the king of onomatopoeia. This guy, the very use of onomatopoeia became a central point in his work. And his name is...
As I love it when you do this to me. His name is Skippy McDoodle.
You don't... Don Martin. Are you serious?
Oh, Don Martin came tripping into my tongue. No, I was just pretending that I didn't know Don Martin was who you're talking about.
Go and look up, and that's another one. You can always find some of his little trade paperbacks that Mad Magazine used to put out. You can find them at flea markets all over the world. This guy did he did Kathwap, Kathwing, Kasquish. He made up onomatopoeia that was so characteristic that at this point, if you use a Don Martin sound effect, people will call you on it because it was so closely related to him. So another good indication to you that maybe going beyond and kind of like what Dave did, thinking about the psychology of the sounds of words, go beyond biff, bang, and pow and see what you can do to come up with some really characteristic sound effects.
Yeah, and since I'm excited by what Brad's onto there, I will say feel the word, like feel it. There's a reason why fonts are designed a certain way. If you have the word squish, feel how squish feels when you draw that word.
Yeah.
And remember that word is in that moment, in that panel, it's a character. It has purpose and need and it does a very big job. So spend as much time as you would on that word as you would as on a character. The payoff is tremendous. And look at your best and favorite childhood comics from DC or Marvel or Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes is great, by the way, for certain sound effects words. Because it's a stylistic choice. That word, if you think of a Calvin and Hobbes word Brad, in the back of your mind right now, if you think of like a stone, if Calvin throwing a stone into water and you're hearing a bloop, you can picture exactly how Watterson would have done that.
Yeah.
And so I would encourage you, I know Brad was talking about using your digital fonts. I would encourage you to spend 6 months, 12 months in the background of your comics and try to do it by hand because it's really instructive. It will only make you a better cartoonist overall. And your ability to handle letters, even if you end up going digitally, it will translate digitally the skill and the time that you've put into doing it analog. So I would, I understand that a lot of people will do it digitally. That's fine. I do it sometimes too. But take the time to try to do it by hand. The payoff can be tremendous. So
I agree.
That's our capstone on that one, Brad. So Brad, what do you want to jump to next? We've done some lettering. We talked about how lettering should be like a mood. We talked about, we settled the issue that Brad, I guess, is right about exclamation points with lettering.
Well, in that case, let's do this. I want to talk about collaboration. It's something that I've really gotten kind of fascinated with. And what I think we need to start doing, especially for the younger web cartoonists, people who are just starting out, I think we need to encourage more collaboration. I'm seeing a lot of comics that are drawn really well, and particularly humor comics, that really struggle with humor writing. And I wonder if maybe we don't need to encourage people who are good at the art, not so good at the writing, to collaborate more. And I'm wondering, do you think that that is a valid pursuit? In other words, is cartooning really such a solitary device that it precludes this kind of idea of collaboration? Or is it just that we haven't pushed the idea and promoted the idea enough?
Well, okay, for this entire topic is fascinating. So I'm super excited to talk about this with you. I think a couple things. I think part of it is based on the heroes that we grew up with. That's one. Part of it is the way that American and Canadian and English-speaking cartoonists are socialized in our culture. That's two. Mm-hmm. And the third one is a lack of exposure to the way that, say, the Japanese do things, right?
Yeah.
And so let's start with the first one. All of our heroes, regardless of who you are, your early childhood heroes were Watterson, were Larson, were Breathed, were Jim Davis, and then the big one, Schultz. Yeah. And all of them, aside from maybe Davis, although you saw as a kid, you saw his name everywhere, so you assumed it was him doing it solo. All of them were very famous for doing it solo. Like that was the American Canadian tradition. Like if you were going to be a cartoonist, a comic strip cartoonist, or an editorial cartoonist, or a panelist, you did it by yourself. You were the jack of all trades, and you were. It was an amazing business, and biggity bam, biggity boom, right? And so we grew up with that. Whereas I think the Japanese. I'm jumping ahead here, but the Japanese grew up in a system where you knew that even if your heroes were famous for their individual titles, you knew they had 3, 4, 5, sometimes 10 people working with them, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the other one that I would say is the way English speaking cartoonists are viewed in their culture. We are brought up to think that a cartoonist has to be a little socially insecure, a little bit fly solo, that a cartoonist can't also enjoy playing volleyball with a team all the time or doesn't go to the gym. Like whenever I see Tom Richmond of Mad Magazine, who's super buff, if you don't know Tom Richmond, it always stands out to me because it's always like, isn't that interesting that even in my own mind, I think of a cartoonist a certain way and Tom Richmond doesn't fit that mold, you know?
Right.
Because Tom can probably bench press me plus an extra, you know, couple of small kids on top of me.
Yes.
Anyway, long story short, I think there's something about the way that American comics have been for the last 50 to maybe even the last 100 years, where even if someone had an assistant, it was almost or collaborated, as a better way to say it, regardless of what level of collaboration, they always hit it because something about American Canadian comics. You were supposed to hide it. You were supposed to be doing this solo. It was a weird cultural thing. Now you tell me, what do you think we don't have more collaboration? We don't have more people working together.
I think it's a combination of things. I think, number one, you're absolutely right in everything that you said.
Yep, great. Yes, finally. Oh, I've been waiting all show for this. Yes, everyone to know. I want everyone to know that I have a big chalkboard next to me in the recording booth here, and there's 7 chit marks for Brad and 1 for me.
You move one of your little magnets across.
And with that cutting comment, I move the magnet back.
No, I think that you're absolutely right, and I think what that tells us is that we need to, especially as people who are talking about webcomics, right? We got to assume that a certain amount of people listening to us are kind of starting out or in the intermediate phases, and they're feeling those growing pains. And I'm talking to you then because you are the person that I need to reach and say that it's okay to collaborate. In fact, if you're somebody who's, you can tell the art of your comic is good, but when you post it, you just are not getting the traction that you think you should be. Chances are the writing is weak. That's usually the case, is that it's the writing. You can have a well-drawn comic and the writing stinks and that comic's going nowhere. And the other side of it is you can have a pretty poorly drawn comic, and if the writing is fantastic, that comic is going to succeed. So if you can look at your comic and see that it's clearly not the art, then it must be the writing. And don't let yourself get caught up into this whole thing. Well, it's not as easy now as it used to be. Social media is too much signal to noise. All that stuff is excuses. There might be a grain of truth to some of it, but it's all excuses that's keeping you away from solving the real problems. So don't get caught up in that. One thing, and this is one of the recurring themes of this show, is that it's all about the quality of your comic. That is the penultimate, the number one thing is it's all about the quality. So that being the case,
I thought it was all about that bass. About that bass.
It is.
No treble.
It is. I thought it was my milkshake brings all the boys to the yard.
Oh, my milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. Can I tell you, one of the things that drives my wife nuts is that I will walk around the house singing a cappella, my milkshake brings all the boys to the yard and their life is better than yours.
You do it like the Pirates of Penzance?
Yeah. And Gloria is like, just stop what you're doing and take a look at what your life is. Right? It's this exact moment. Like, I'll be working in the yard, and I'll realize that a neighbor is looking at me, and I'm realizing that I'm singing, my milkshake brings all the boys to the yard.
Now that's a Patreon exclusive right there.
That's a milkshake that brings no one to the yard.
That's right. But listen, I think we need to start talking about collaboration. I think we need to start encouraging it more. And if you do fall into this zone where it's like, you know, it's not the art, and that tells you it must be the writing. And let's face it, go back and read some of your old stuff once it's not fresh in your mind anymore. And you'll see that maybe what I'm saying has a little bit of truth to it. The next question becomes, where do you find a collaborator?
Well, this is hard. That's a hard question.
Yeah, because it's easy to sit here and say, well, you guys need to be collaborating more. Where the heck do they find? I've got some thoughts, but I want to hear if all of a sudden you were I waved a magic wand and your writing wasn't hitting. Where would you start to look for collaborators?
Okay, so in a way, what you're saying to people is it's like taking your teen kids by the shoulders and saying, "Hey, you need to have friends. You need to have more friends." And then, the follow-up advice is, "Go get some friends." And okay, thanks, Dad. Yeah. Great, I need to get friends. No, but where to find collaboration? So my advice is that there are times in your life where you can do manageably sized projects. I wouldn't just jump in with somebody on a 400-page book if you've never worked with them before.
Right.
Or work on a project that you know is going to take a year and a half. Say like, hey, I've been reading your stuff online. Your tweets are really funny and your blog posts are really funny. Would you ever want to write a comic? And if so, let's just try a 5-page comic together and see what we can do.
Yeah.
Or alternately, if you know your writing is stronger than your drawing, there are people all over DeviantArt or Instagram or Twitter that are posting amazing stuff. And you're like, they got the makings of a real good cartoonist here. What if I wrote you a 5-page script? Would you be willing to try and collaborate on it?
Yeah.
And I think that's the way I would approach it, is manageable size chunks. What are your thoughts? How would you advise someone?
So recently, my son, my older son, started high school, and it's a really wonderful high school, but it's project based. In other words, they're not about the midterm exam and the final exam and stuff like that. They get graded throughout the semester on projects. So if you're learning biochemistry, by the end of the semester, you do a project that's biochem based that shows that you have learned the stuff that's along the way, right? Learn the stuff during the, it's neat. But of course, you know what the number one problem of project-based learning, you group up, you've got three or four people working on a project, and you know what happens every time a group works on a project. You've got one person that puts in all the work, one person that puts in none of the work, and two people that coast and create more problems than they solve along the way. And this is what, in his freshman year, we found that to be the case on a couple where there was one or two kids that were coasting, and my son had to kind of deal with, this kid didn't turn in his part of the project and it's due today and we get graded as a group, what happens, blah, blah. So of course we sit down with the teachers during parent teacher conferences and we express our concerns. And this is something that, of course, being a project-based high school, they hear from every parent. It's like they bring out the sheet and start reading down it. But what they said really, really resonated with me. Okay. They go, it's okay. She said, they go, as far as, you know, his grades, we know who's doing the work and who's not. And we find ways to make everything reflect the actual work. But here's the thing that was interesting. She goes, these kids are going to be going to high school together for 4 years. And what's going to happen very quickly is once a kid doesn't pull his or her own weight, they get a reputation. And the kids that work hard on projects are going to start grouping together and not getting those kids into their groups, not letting those coasters into the group. And through just evolution, the kids that work hard are going to start buddying up. The middlers are going to start buddying up. And the people who don't put a lot of work in are all going to be left to group with each other. And that is exactly how I foresee these collaborations going. In other words, it's also another way of saying all that is you got to kiss a lot of frogs before you get the prince or the princess in the fairy tale. Do exactly what Dave is saying. Go through a number of mini collaborations with a number of people and see who the people are who can deliver. See who the people are that you work well with. See who the people are whose sense of humor or the sense of writing meshes with your own. And do a bunch of these micro collaborations, maybe just one little piece, not even a four page, maybe just a panel, maybe a four panel. And the places to look for these, I've been thinking, are number one, Dave hit it right on the head, people with funny tweets. People who have, you can look through their Twitter feed and they are, that's the especially if you're doing like panel work, that's the place to find a single panel cartoonist writer right there is somebody who can write a funny one tweet piece. Yes. But also take a look at the memes and you've got to be careful, like on a site like Imgur, people posting original content memes, not necessarily reposted stuff, but stuff that they created original content. A meme is just another form of a cartoon, really. It's the same idea. It's an image plus words. That is where you find potential cartoon collaborators. And also there's places on Reddit where the focus is on humor writing and writing in general. And I think those are some places that you can do exactly what Dave is saying. Reach out and just talk about a micro collaboration. Hey, I'd like to do a couple comics with you. What do you think? It might be kind of fun. And then if it starts to build and if you see that you work well with this person and something starts to build up, then maybe take it to the next level and say, hey, what do you think about doing this a little bit regular? And then your next step, obviously, before you start working on the reg, is get that contract. You know, you gotta, as we said in a previous episode, you've got to start codifying expectations. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's great. I think a couple things that popped into my mind. First of all, You pronounced I-M-G-U-R as imager? Is that how you pronounce it?
There's a big debate on the site. It's either Imgur or imager. And that's another, speaking of great debates, that's one that is as common as the GIF debate.
What a shit name is the short version of that when you have entire people not knowing how to pronounce it. So that's a short
Have you
version.
Ever been on that site?
Yeah, I want to say yes, for a while there, that was the Reddit, that was the way to upload comics to Reddit, wasn't it? You had to use Imgur. I always pronounce it as Imgur, but maybe.
Well, it could go either way, but if you're looking for social media for a particularly single panel comics, it's very, very good. I had an intern working with me a couple summers ago from the University of the Arts, and she turned me on to it and very patiently walked me through the philosophy of what tends to go there, you know, the community and so forth.
Right.
And it is a really good place to post your cartoons just and get a little bit of traction and some following. But anyway, yes. Those are some places I think you could go.
Yeah. So that was, I don't know why that was my top of line question that I had to get answered. So you pronounce it imager. So that was one. And then the other one is, I sympathize with your son, because in high school, I always felt like I never got to pick my teams in high school.
Yeah.
And so I always felt like I got, me as an A student, got paired up with just Stoner of the Year. And it was like, I can't do it today, bro. The surf's up to 6 feet. No way. I can't. Listen, we're going to have to work on that later, brother. I'm sorry about that, man. And I was like, come on, dude. Just 2 hours. That's all we need. So anyway, you're getting a window into conscientious high schooler Dave Kellett there.
Yeah.
But I like that idea that basically the quality will winnow to the top, because it's not unlike what we advocate with comics, which is that you can't keep the good stuff down. So if you feel like you, like your son on that team where he's complaining that he's doing the only good work, over the course of his 4 years, you won't be able to keep him down. He'll find the good teams. He'll find success, because that has a way of winning itself out. And so I agree with their teacher about that. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as micro projects, I think that's the way to go. In a fun side note to that, over the years, the last, I don't know, 2-3 years, I've been hiring cartoonists and writers and illustrators to do short stories for Drive, my science fiction comic.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And I have to tell you, it's been a fun way to test out, totally not the way I intended it to be, but it's been a fun way to test out who I would like to work with again on something.
Yeah.
I can pull you aside after the show and be like, boy, this person was a train wreck. Oh boy, this person never met a deadline that they couldn't break. Or boy, this person really phoned it in. But then you also have, I've had 4, 5, 6 of them where it was just like, wow, they really rose to the occasion and they had fun with it. And the artwork was beautiful. The writing was beautiful. This is great. This is so creative. It added to the universe. It's amazing. So I've been very happy with that as a process, because it's fun to open up your sandbox and let other people play in it and see what they'll do with it. And then B, it's fun just to see what they bring with their skill set to these little mini projects and how you might like to work with them again on the future for a bigger project. So I guess that's been my way of testing out collaboration, is a short version of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I like that idea. I think the micro collaboration is something, and also it's low risk, right? It's something that if it doesn't work out, you're not really out anything. It's more like something that you do on a whim, and be prepared that some people just might not have time, might not want, might just think that you're kind of like they might be standoffish because they're like, okay, what's this person's angle? You know, what are they really up to?
How are they playing me? What's going on?
Yeah. But here's what I do want to hear from our listeners. I want to hear, if you do try this, tell us how it works out. Tell us, point us to some fruits of some of these micro collaborations, because it's something that I really want to address in the year and the next year to come, because I think it's something that is a deficit in webcomics, is the lack of collaboration. We've got a lot of people who are half of a good team that just hasn't been formed yet. And I'd like to see if the advice we give today is actually helpful.
I love how every time you keep saying, about someone who just is half of a team and they don't know that their writing is soft, but their art is amazing. I keep feeling like you're subtweeting me every time you say this. Dave just needs to realize that Sheldon just needs a different writer. It's what he needs.
Please listen. Being totally honest, between the two of us, you are the better writer, without a doubt. You're definitely the better humor writer, without any competition. And our art is so different that I don't think that we can compare it. But you are a really, really good humor writer. You can't even pretend about that.
On that note, this is now the final episode of Comic Lab. I did this entire show, just tears streaming down my cheek. I just did this entire show just to get to that moment.
The answer was in you all along.
It's like a ghost. It's like a ghost that's finally allowed to move on because they accomplished what they set out to do.
You're just gonna hover in the background and disappear.
I'm just like an angel. But Brad, I'm being called home now. I can go now. It's okay. It's okay to let go. This is all I needed. I'm floating up. Bye, Brad. Bye. Have a wonderful life.
Oh, shucks. So yeah, I think we've pretty much done that topic in as you fade into the distance, and we've got time for one more topic. Do you have anything you'd like to talk about?
I like what you said as you fade into the distance. yeah, I have one that I would like to talk about. This one is one that it's been percolating in my mind for a while because it keeps happening for me with Drive, and I want to talk to you about it because you have had probably a decade more experience writing long form comics, or at least medium form comics with Evil Inc., where stories that'll stretch, weeks at a time, if not years. So you'll know of what I speak. So here's my conundrum that I keep coming up with Drive. And I wanted to ask you this specific question. So when you're writing for long form, what do you, Brad Geiger, do when you know what the next 20, 30, even 40 steps of your stories are going to be, right? For your story is going to be.
Yeah.
But you don't know what the next immediate step is going to be, what this next page has to be. What do you do, Brad Geiger?
Oh.
Raconteur. I don't know why I'm there.
Man about town. Gadfly. Right. I've got a tried and true method that actually works because this is actually more common than you think. Because what happens is I think a lot of us write kind of an outline and we know where the overall story is going, but the individual steps we don't have worked out yet. And I would even argue a lot of times the individual steps don't matter as long as they're interesting steps and they lead to the proper place. So this happens to me quite a bit where I find myself like, okay, I know I got to get to this other place but I don't know what my next step is. And I try variations of this. I change the scene entirely. In other words, if right now the wife has to have a talk with her husband because she found a strange shoe behind the couch, right? And I know where this story's got to go, but I don't know the next step. Change the scene from go completely away from where you think the next logical step should be.
Okay.
Maybe the next step is a woman who finds herself with only one shoe, right? Maybe we take it from that angle, right? Okay? Or maybe we find where the other shoe is. But the next step is not necessarily the woman confronts her husband. Maybe the next step is in another town or another situation that leads back to that place. But what I usually find when I'm in that spot is that I'm too hardwired into A, B, C, D, E. And sometimes good storytelling is A, B, C, G, H, D. You know, sometimes when you come to a fork in the road, you got to take it.
Right.
And sometimes what it happened to me not so long ago where there was a conversation between characters. I knew where it had to go. And I was not getting anywhere. And a micro step of this is just to change the first word balloon. Like a lot of time, the first in that dumb example I used, the first word balloon is, "Hey, I found a shoe behind the couch." Maybe you change that first word balloon, and maybe have the husband say the first thing. Maybe it's something small like that.
Oh, just to prime the pump. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Just instead of trying it from where I logically think it's got to go, maybe starting from another angle. But like what I did not so long ago is I had a supervillain rampaging above the city. The superhero was rushing up to intercede. And I knew they had to collide, but I didn't know how. And what I ended up doing was changing the scene to a police officer sitting in his car, getting the call that there was a supervillain on the loose. And that led to some very comedic moments where he tries to weasel out of it, right? And I was able to make an entire bridge from the these two are going to have a fight to these two are in each other's face. I had an entire bridge that was very, very humorous, very interesting, very clever, I thought. But it had nothing to do with superhero and villain. I changed the scene. All of a sudden, you're getting those plot points in the background as these cops and the dispatcher goes back and forth, and the cop's trying to get away from being assigned this job because the last person that went up against this Firestarter supervillain, to quote the final punchline on the page, his ass looked like Burger King's by the end. You know, so change the scene. Sometimes the whole reason you're having problems is that you're all focused on logic, A, B, C, D, and sometimes good storytelling doesn't go in a straight line. What do you think? Well, how do you address this?
Well, I'm interested by your suggested route, because I'll tell you the way I approach writing Drive, and you can tell me your thoughts on this, is that I try to maintain there's about four or five main storylines, main plot points that are humming along at any given point in Drive, right? Mm. And what I try to do, much like a punchline, you know, you build tension like blowing up a balloon, and then you pop it.
Yeah.
But what I try to do with Drive, and I think I learned this from, it was either Tolkien or Sherlock Holmes, what I try to do is right before you would pop it, you've been building tension, you switch storylines. and then you build that next one up, build it up. And right before you would have some celebratory moment or some big action moment or a big revelatory moment about someone's character, right before you do that, you switch scenes, and people are like, "Oh God, I want to know what happens." What? And so
for me,
what that achieves is that it's constant cliffhanger moments that are also very satisfactory when you jump back to them, because people are like, "Oh right, I forgot about this. We were just about to find out what his brother's name was," or "Oh yeah, that's right. This is when the gold gets revealed," or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And so I'm interested that your idea for getting stuck on the next page is to switch storylines, basically, or to switch angles, or to switch. I hadn't thought of that, is the genuine response. And I want to percolate on that and think if that can help me through these moments with Drive. I think that's probably a good suggestion, if for no other reason than I have found it successful to do in my writing where I'm building up tension. So maybe it's also good when I'm finding a moment where the story, at least for me, is at the skids, and I'm not sure which way to go next. Maybe I need to intentionally jump into a different storyline. Like if I'm feeling it in the story, maybe the readers are too. So it's definitely time to switch stories, you know?
I was just going to say that it might be your subconscious telling you that it's time to switch the scene.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I'm sorry, that was way too enthusiastic. that's great, Brad. Suddenly I become that guy that I was teamed up with in high school. Oh, brother, this is going to be a great project. We're going to have a great time.
I thought you turned into Billy Mays there for a minute. Yeah, this is the best chamois you're ever going to have.
Billy Mays. Wow. What a reference. That's great.
But no, I think it might be your subconscious telling you that it's time to switch the scene. And also just realize that it is possible to get too wound up in a linear storytelling. And let's just put a pause on that just for a second. 9 chances out of 10, if you're starting a new comic, you're starting it in the wrong place. You're starting at the beginning. Nobody wants to start at the beginning. You start at the action. You start with something bizarre happening. How does a Drive had a very good opening sequence, right? It was that thing that goes through an asteroid that goes through the guy's head, right?
Yes.
Okay. I want to make sure I was remembering it right.
No, I wasn't being dismissive. You're right. Yeah.
it was bizarre. It got my attention. It was weird, right? And it's like, what the heck am I in for? If you would have started with, you know, in the beginning, there was heaven and earth, and then the animals were created, and finally there's a mobster in Chicago. That's too long. That's we don't need all that backstory. The first thing you got to do is get in there, get an emotional hook, and get that reader interested. Then you can do the backstory.
Can I use my literature majors for a minute, Brad?
Please, please.
So the thing that you were describing is called in medias res, and it's a Latin phrase from the poet Horace. And what it means literally in translation is in the middle of things. You want to start in the middle of things because at the beginning of the story, someone is taking their first step out their door and is like, you know, they're picking at their nose as they walk the first couple miles. But if you start in medias res, in the middle of things, that adventurer is now fighting the dragon. It's 2 days later and he's at the cave and like no one gives a shit about his first couple days where he's eating the fruit and as he's walking along the path. That in fact, that was a lot of the problem with the Hobbit movie being stretched into three movies is like no one cares about Bilbo getting his mail. No one gives a shit. Even even hardcore Tolkien fans were like, move it along. No one gives a shit. Great, the dwarves are doing dishes. I don't care. This is a dishwasher commercial. So starting in medias res, like they figured that out way long ago in Greco-Roman times that you want to start in the middle of things because just like at a party where you have friends standing 10 feet away and you hear the essence of a story and they're like, and that's why the car glass was flying everywhere and the door was crushed and the dude's foot. And so you leave your conversation to walk across the room to go, wait, what are you talking about? What is this? Because they are in the middle of it. They're in the thick and in the most exciting part of the story. And that's where you want to start your story is in medias res, not at the beginning, like Brad said.
Yeah, don't get caught up in linear storytelling. I know it's a little bit of a trope at this point where we see the movie that starts with the guy, you know, falling out of a, you know, getting pushed out of a skyscraper window and he's hurtling towards the ground and we hear the record scratch and he turns the camera and says, I bet you're wondering how I got here.
Yes, exactly.
Right. That's kind of a trope. But that's a great start to a story. I'm in.
That sucker works.
Yeah. There's a reason that they do it.
Right. Yeah. Thor Ragnarok, you don't care how he got caught in that cage. Oh, you want to start there because that's where it gets fun.
Other than the fact that I just saw Incredibles 2 and I think it's a really strong contender, I think Thor Ragnarok is the best of the Marvel movies because it had that whimsy in the storytelling.
I got to tell you, Thor Ragnarok, without hesitation, has become my favorite Marvel movie. I think...
Hands down.
Yeah, I think...
I agree.
Taika, if I'm pronouncing his name right, Taika, I think, did a fantastic job of taking what to me was the most boresnore brand of any of the Marvel movies. Like, watch Thor the Dark World or whatever that thing was again. You'll get 10 minutes in and go like, this is a shining piece of shit. This is terrible. Ragnarok has joy in it. It has fun in it. It has friendship. It has a flowing story that bounces along really well. I get that's a beautifully made movie. It's really, really good.
Yeah. I think that you could do worse than to model yourself after that kind of storytelling. And the first lesson you take is that opening sequence where he's caught in chains and in the middle of a conversation with the fire giant. It's just great storytelling, and it's not necessarily linear.
And just, you know what, let's talk about a comedic punch too. Right as either Thor is talking, or I'm forgetting the demon's name, Sardis, what was it?
Surtur.
Is right when either Surtur's getting to a good point or Thor's getting to a good point, right? The tension's building, that balloon is building. It's about to pop, but the script takes that moment to have Thor then slowly spinning around and going, I'm coming back around again. Just give me a second. Like, that is a great example of delaying that comedic tension or delaying that tension for a comedic punch. It's a beautiful line delivery. Yeah. Anyway, not to get too far into that, but anyway, where were we? In medias res. Go ahead, Brad.
It is worth talking about that when you are stuck. Instead of focusing on the fact, oh, I'm brain locked, I've got writer's block, I've got this, I've got that, take a minute to consider the fact that maybe your subconscious is trying to give you a little hand and get you away from that straight line and say, okay, this might be a good place to change the scene. And if nothing else, that exercise of thinking about what's happening elsewhere that's in relationship to your central storyline might lead you to the next step. And it's not necessarily changing the scene, but it's but you couldn't have gotten there without going through that exercise of thinking about what's going on someplace else. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and you know what? Another reason why I think your suggestion is brilliant is, have you ever had it where you're working a problem, and nothing's coming, right? You're just like,
yes.
You can see the sparks flying from the spinning wheels in your brain and nothing's happening. But you step away for 20 minutes, or you go take a shower, or you plant a flower, or you walk a dog, or you pick your kids up from school, or you go make a sandwich. You literally do anything else, and suddenly there's the idea, right? Or the solution.
There it is.
And so another reason, as I'm thinking about this, of why your suggested route is maybe a really good one, is because you're basically giving your brain a couple days, a couple weeks off to say, no, explore another storyline for a while. Have fun with that. In the meantime, I'm going to be working on this in the background, and I'll check back in with you when we have a good idea for you. And I think you are right, Brad. I think, you know what? I'm going to put a little check mark right by Brad's name, and I'm going to erase the one by my name.
Oh, good. I got my magnet back.
I forgot you had done it as magnets. Oh, you delightful SOB. All right.
Well, if that's the case, Dave, then I've got nothing left to do but to, I do think we put a little button on that. I think we've talked it right into submission. I think it's sometimes that the best way to work on this is not to get hyper-focused on it, but to give yourself a little relaxation and go and walk another path for a while.
I think you're right. I think, yep, to echo your point right there, I think it's a statement to the logical side of your brain is working the problem too hard, and you need to let the emotional take over for a minute. I think you're probably right.
Well, in that case, I'm going to get out my guitar. Hold on. Ah, there it is. And I'll say that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the continuously improving guitarist Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com, and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is Use With Permission, Don't Let Brad's Guitar Playing Fool You. It's Use With Permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.
But I gotta say, Brad, your guitaring is getting better.